Get ready for Ready Radio with Doug and Amy. It's emergency preparedness for everyone. Brought to you by TruPrep. For all your prepping needs, visit TruPrep online at truprep.com or visit a TruPrep store in Roswell or Marietta. Listen in as Doug and Amy provide helpful tips on how to get ready for anything that comes your way. And now, your hosts, Doug and Amy.
Welcome, everybody. You're listening to Ready Radio this week with Doug and Amy. We're going to be talking a little bit about quantitative easing, and this is a big topic for everybody, not just for preppers and people with an emergency mindset, because over the last 5 years, the Federal Reserve has engaged in a new policy of quantitative easing, and this is not a new idea. This is an idea that goes all the way back to the early 1920s into the mid-1930s, and the idea of how do you manage monetary supply and what effects does it have. And the financial crisis of 2008 spurred the Fed to go off in a new direction, which I personally find terrifying, and the effects of which we have not really had come to fruition over the last couple of years. Of course, the Federal Reserve is not an entity of the federal government. It sounds like it is, but it has absolutely nothing to do with the federal government. The Federal Reserve is a group basically of banks that form together to print money. The banks are in charge of the monetary policy. They take and handle liquidity issues. And even though Congress is charged with printing the money, there was an agreement that was reached where these central bankers would come together and set forth policy in regards to how much currency is in production at any one time and how much is out for people to be able to use. And the more available cash you have, that means you end up with more money chasing fewer and fewer goods. So that causes inflation. And inflation in and of itself is actually a very good thing. I don't think you're going to find many economists these days who will turn around and say inflation is a bad thing and we should strive for a zero inflation currency, because inflation creates a lot of pressures on an economy and a society which are beneficial. For example, Amy, why would you go buy a new car?
Probably because mine now has 200,000 miles on it, because I drive very far to and from work. Mm-hmm. And I guess if it were to break down or just stop running, it's time for a new one.
Okay, that's a great reason to go out and buy a new car. What if I told you that 6 months from now, all the cars were going to be 10% off? What would you do?
I'd probably wait for 6 months.
What if you knew that in 12 months they were going to be 15% off?
I might try, if I could, to get my car fixed and wait for 12 months.
Let's flip that on its head. What if I told you in 6 months all the cars are going to be 10% more?
Well, then I'd go ahead and purchase one.
Right. So if the value of your dollar is going up, people save because they want to recoup the maximum value of their dollar. That's deflation. If the value of the dollar is going down, people spend, because they want to take advantage of the current value of money savings. And this is a long-term dynamic, and everybody does it. If you're looking at products, if you know the price of the product is going to be going down, you save and wait until it reaches rock bottom, try to guess the market. If you know the value of a product is going up, you try to buy it now, and that leads to either a surplus for an individual or even a hoarding mentality, because people want to recoup the maximum value of their dollar. Either,
right, and we're kind of saying that with the housing market too, with the fluctuations. Right.
As people see the, and when the housing market was tanking, people were waiting, and now that the housing market is starting to come up again, people want to spend so that they don't, that they don't get caught on the crest of that wave.
Right, and interest rate, of course, you want to take advantage of the interest rates as well.
Yes, and we will get to interest rates and how inflation influences interest rates in a couple of minutes, and that's a very important aspect. But for right now, looking at, the whole, inflation is not a bad thing because it spurs people to spend, and in our economy is a consumer-based economy. About 70% of everything we do is consumer-based. So the more the fewer people are buying, the less jobs there are, and then the less reinvestment in industry. So we have to keep people putting money back into the economy. And the speed at which money changes hands is incredibly important in this dynamic. The more people sit on their money, the less velocity, that's the term that's used for the exchange of money between entities, the lower the velocity, the more you have hoarding and the fewer jobs are produced and the fewer goods are produced because people are not moving the money around to get the basis of an economy flowing. So we need people to not sit on huge amounts of money. We need them to do something with that money. And this is an important aspect of savings. Now, if you take your money and stick it in a mattress, then you're destroying economic velocity. You're getting to a point where people are no longer doing anything with their money. If you take all your money, instead of buying a new TV, you buy stocks, you've then created more velocity. You've invested it instead of just taking it out of the market. And right now, we have so much money that's tied up into things that are not creating economic velocity. There's no money moving. Banks are sitting on money. They're not lending it. And this is one of the keystones of the financial collapse was that the banks were undervalued or underfunded, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you remember that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Well, what we did in order to prevent future economic catastrophes like the economic crisis of 2008 was say, well, you have to have more liquidity. You have to have more money in your institution to cover the loans that you're putting out so that if people call in debts or things go bad, you have enough funds to cover it. Well, that means that the banks all suddenly had to have a larger reserve of cash, which they can't lend or do anything with. That decreased the money supply. Well, with the money supply coming down, what effect does that have? Well, then you have less money chasing more goods, which leads to deflation. When you have more money chasing fewer goods, you get inflation. That means that people want to spend. They want to spend now. When you have less money chasing more goods, you have deflation, and people don't want to spend, which going into a recession would be catastrophic, right?
Right. I would assume so, yes.
I mean, if you've got people who now have this impetus not – I mean, first of all, you've got insecurity because you don't know if you're going to have a job, huge unemployment numbers, the real unemployment numbers, the U6 numbers – those are the ones that aren't reported.
Mm-hmm.
The U6 numbers at the height of the financial crisis in about 2009, 2010 were running 17.1%.
As opposed to?
The U1 numbers, which were reporting between 8 and 10%.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
And the difference between U1 and U6 is that U6 takes into consideration everybody who is not working,
mm-hmm.
whereas U1 only takes consideration those who have filed unemployment claims in the last few weeks. So when you look at, like, the media reports, not us, but everybody else out mm-hmm. there, when you start talking about U1 numbers there or unemployment numbers, they're talking U1. They're talking about who has just been laid off, who just lost their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
They're not talking about the total number of people who are not working. When you had almost 20% of Americans not working, of people who were eligible to work. I mean, mm-hmm. we're not talking about, you know, like senior citizens or children or
right.
people with long-term disabilities. We're talking about people who in the last 5 years have been in the job market, who had a stable income and who are able to continue on without a retirement or other means of leaving the job industry. So when you look at nearly 20% of all Americans not having a job who should be working, I mean, that's a staggering number. I mean, that is depression era numbers for unemployment. In the Great Depression, we ran around 30% unemployment, true unemployment, like mm-hmm. U6 numbers. So, I mean, this is a huge deal. We were in the grips of something catastrophic. The U6 numbers today, in 2014, are still around 12%, mm-hmm. which is staggering, too. I mean, and that doesn't really take into consideration underemployment. When you have somebody who, you know, let's say has an advanced degree and is working at a checkout counter, I mean, that's underemployment, and that really hurts too. And when you look at the total economy, what jobs are we replacing? Yes, we've had some jobs created, but all of the jobs that have been created in the last year or so have been the menial labor jobs. We're not recreating jobs for, you know, librarians and doctors and lawyers and things like that. Those jobs, the higher end jobs are not growing.
Right. And we're seeing a lot of part-time jobs also.
Yes.
And multiple, where people will have multiple part-time jobs. You know, a lot of it's because of the health insurance and things like that too.
And upper middle management and upper management jobs are not being created. It's all the entry-level jobs. And then the people who are filling entry-level jobs are people who have higher skill sets than entry-level jobs require, which pushes people who don't have any skill sets out of the market. I was listening to a report just this last week on NPR talking about how high school dropouts are completely out of luck in major cities. That they are competing with people who have bachelor's degrees.
Right.
For the same jobs. And there's, even though this job does not require a bachelor's degree to get it, none of the efforts in that job would require that amount of education, there's still applicants who have that who are applying for it because they can't get anything else. So it's caused this, like, this push down. So, you know, and that's, it's incredibly inefficient from an economic standpoint. Why would you go and pay $40,000 or $60,000 to get a degree to get a job that doesn't require the use of it? You'd be better off not saddling yourself with $60,000 in debt and just being able to go get the job you were going to get anyway. But you can't get that job without the degree. So there's an education bubble that's formed. And this is very dangerous. I mean, you think about velocity and money. There's a lot of money going into these education institutions that are not providing any value. They're not making a better worker, really. They're not making the society a better place, but they're draining off a huge amount of debt. And these kids are saddled with it because they're taking debt. And granted, it's very low interest. And I encourage people to take low interest loans when they can. But having this amount of debt is crushing over time. And the amount of debt in this society is something that's going to lead to what we're going to talk about in the next segment with the Weimar Republic. Folks, you're listening to Ready Radio on News Talk 1160, the talk of the town.
And now, back to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy.
Welcome back, everybody. When we took our break, we were talking about financial debt. And debt is really an important aspect of quantitative easing. And we're going to get to what the Fed's program was very shortly, but we need a little bit of a history lesson to understand what debt and inflation can do to an economy. When we look back in World War I, Germany had financed their entire, France financed their war through the imposition of the first ever income tax. Britain issued bonds, where people would buy savings bonds, basically pay money into the government. The government spent the money and promised to pay it back at a later date with interest. Germany just financed it entirely through borrowing. And so they had racked up huge amounts of debt by the time the war ended. And the war ended poorly for them, which was even worse, because now they were not in any real means to, you know, capitalize on the gains from the war. They didn't gain any land. They didn't gain any industry. They were right where back where they started from with a whole bunch of debt, which I think is very analogous to student financial debt these days, because you take on a huge amount of debt and end up back taking the same job that 20 years ago you would get without taking any of that debt on. So it's forcing kind of like a servitude. And that's what happened to Germany. They were ordered to pay back not only the debt that they ran up creating the war, but also war reparations to Germany and France and I believe America. I'm not sure about that one. But because of the cost of the war and the Treaty of Versailles, they were ordered to make huge payments of their gross domestic product. Something around 15 to 20% of their gross domestic product was supposed to be paid to these other countries to make up from them waging war. And it was crushing. So Germany had, at that time, come off of the gold standard, and we'll discuss what the gold standard is in a minute, but Germany had come off the gold standard. They were issuing a fiat currency to be able to finance their war. Whenever they needed money, they would simply print money, and that would create more money to give people. Now, the downside of creating more money is that you then have more money chasing fewer goods, and that causes inflation, which means prices go up. This is the inflating of the price of goods rather than devaluing the currency. So as the price of goods go up, you need more money to buy those goods, and you get into this vicious cycle of, well, if you need more money to buy the goods, then we'll print more money so you have more money to buy the goods, which leads to the price of the goods going up. It's not as seen as harsh in goods that are created in the country that's doing this, but for any foreign goods or foreign exchange rates, when you talk about hard currencies, as the value of your money goes down, the value of the other currencies stays static but goes up in relation to yours and the value of any goods you're importing. So if you're a country that imports heavily, inflation will skyrocket the price of imported goods. And so let me ask you this, Amy. Name one non-durable good, a consumable good that we import heavily that everybody uses every day.
I would say petroleum.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
And what has happened to the price of petroleum over the last 2 years?
Oh gosh, it's ugly. unless you drive a hybrid.
What about since 2008? You hear all these people talk about the price of gas when Obama took office. Do you remember what gas was back when Obama took office?
Gosh, I can't even remember what it was back then.
It was around $1.50 to $1.80 a gallon. And what are we paying today?
Close to about $4.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you've seen the price of gas almost triple mm-hmm. in the last 3 years. Now, has there been a huge refinery explosion? Has there been a large oil field depleted? Have we had any news that would cause a decrease in the amount of those goods?
No, absolutely not.
Okay, so it's not that we have fewer goods. It's not that we have mm-hmm. more money chasing fewer goods. Or it's not that we have fewer goods to be chased. We have the same amount of goods. So the only reason for those prices to go up that dramatically would be having more money to chase them.
Right.
Okay. What's the price of protein, meat, right now?
Oh, gosh.
All-time high.
Yeah, it keeps going up. It seems like every time I go to the grocery store, it's higher and higher.
Yes, and it's not just beef or just chicken or just pork or just seafood. It's across the board.
It is. Mm-hmm.
And so if you have – there can't be a single exacerbating factor on that many different products, right? There's not like that there's been a famine in some country or that there's been a disease like mad cow disease, which decreased the amount of beef that caused some aspect of it to spike. All of it spiked. And you know how much it spiked by? Almost three times what it used to be. Mm. Now, isn't that interesting that the price
of... And it kind of sneaks up on you. It's like you don't wake up one day and all of a sudden it's three times higher. It's just like, you know, you go to the grocery store and you notice maybe little small changes.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like after a couple of months, you're like, wait a minute.
Yeah, well, and that's the effect of central planning on this. Mm-hmm. This is being done with a theory. Because when we go back to the Weimar Republic in Germany, they did not have very good central planning on how to keep up with inflation. So what they did was they decided that they were going to pay back their reparations with inflated dollars. So they started to print more money to pay them back. And then all of the countries that they were owed money to said, we don't trust your money. We don't want your money. We want our money. So you need to buy our money on the open market and give it back to us. Which created this like downward spiral. And the money started to inflate so much that it went past inflation and reached a point of hyperinflation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
By 1923, okay, In 1910, before the war got started, it was about 2 or 3 German marks to the dollar. So if you brought in 2 or 3 German marks, you'd get a dollar bill back. Do you want to know what the exchange rate was for marks in 1923 at the height of their inflationary spiral?
Do tell.
Take a guess. Any guess.
I don't
10
know.
10 to 1, 100
I was
going to
say maybe
1,000.
15 to 1.
15 to 1. 4 trillion to 1.
What?
Yes.
Oh, my.
4 trillion to 1.
How is that even possible?
You just keep printing it. You just keep printing it until there's so many marks in current. There are stories of people going to buy bread with a barrel full of marks. During the height, employees demanded to be paid in marks twice a day. They wanted their wages at noon and at 5.
Wow.
Because they went on their lunch break and bought as much as they could. Because by 5 o'clock, their money would be worth less.
Wow.
That's hyperinflation. Mm-hmm. And you say, you know, it kind of sneaks up on you. When you have regular inflation, mm-hmm. it's over a period of time. You don't really notice that. You notice gas prices go up a penny or down 2 pennies and up 5 pennies and right. down 3 pennies and mm-hmm. up 10 pennies and then down 4 pennies. And so you get this kind of ebb and flow and you don't really notice it. When you reach a period of hyperinflation, everybody is crucially aware of it. And the money is just every minute that you're not spending it, it's losing value.
Mm-hmm.
So you're trying to constantly turn money into durable goods. And then that breaks down. Hopefully someplace before the 4 trillion to 1 mark, but when the currency breaks down to a point where people say, I will not be paid in that, then the whole system collapses. Well, then we go back to a barter economy. And you say, this, and you come in and you're like, wow, that gallon of milk is 36 trillion marks. Can I sweep the floor for a half hour and get a gallon of milk? And when you start to barter,
right,
then the entire currency is just gone.
Right. And I know that over at True Prep, they carry Keystone meats. And since, you know, the protein is one of the things that has been really going up, I actually know of quite a few people who go in and actually have been purchasing cases of this Keystone meat.
Yeah, and the prices at True Prep are very good, and that's one of the things, is that you haven't seen them inflate their prices. Although I know from talking to the owners that they've had price increases, and even there, we're starting to see the effects of inflation, that prices are going up. Now, looking at it over the last, say, 2 or 3 years, you don't get as good a picture, because the let's say, like the meat over at True Prep, it's already had factored in the higher price of energy and the higher price of meat to a certain degree. And it takes a longer time for things that are already in production and sitting in warehouses to feel the pressure as opposed to fresh meat. Because your fresh meat was a cow, a consumable good only a month ago. And now it's being sold on the open market for what your real value is. Whereas those canned meats may have been a cow 2 years ago and then processed and then canned and then warehoused and then sold to a retailer and then put on their shelves. And so it has less of the pressure that it's feeling from the open market, but it will come.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the time. And with the end of quantitative easing in October, this is the time to start to get on the ball with having everything put up, because inflation is coming. Right now, our interest rates are incredibly low. Our interest rates are floating around 0%. Interest rates cannot remain low in a environment where bonds are not being purchased with fiat currency. And we'll get to what quantitative easing means in a minute. Looking back at Germany, and Germany is a great example of what could happen without, you know, proper planning. The money was worthless. The goods were there. And people think, well, you know, Germany after the war, okay? And the images that are in our generation of Germany after the war are Germany after World War II, after the firebombing of Dresden, after complete total war where the economic structures were attacked. That wasn't World War I. World War I was not like that. World War I was trench warfare with defined boundaries. They weren't flying bombers over and taking out industrial capacity. Germany came through pretty much unscathed in its industrial production. So when it came out of, and the other countries, France and Belgium, were pretty heavily hit. England was okay, but it didn't have as much, you know, manufacturing capacity as Germany by a long shot. Germany should have ruled the roost after World War I economically and been able to do a lot of things. But this debt, this crushing debt, was sucking away all of their ability to expand. It caused negative growth in their economy. And when that happens, then you end up with hyperinflation at the end of the road, and that's a very scary thing. When we come back, Amy, I'd like to discuss with you a little bit more about what quantitative easing was in 2008, how it's happened through the next couple of years, and what the end of it really means. You're listening to Ready Radio on News Talk 1160, the talk of the town.
And now, back to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy.
Welcome back, folks. When we took our break, we were just starting to get into quantitative easing in the modern term. And what we'd been discussing was the way the Weimar Republic had spent and created money out of nothing in order to try to buy hard currencies. The Allied powers had said that you have to make reparations to us in hard currency. The Weimar Republic turned around and said, okay, well then we will buy hard currency at any price. It started to print more and more marks in order to be able to acquire hard currency, which created an inflationary spiral, led to a hyperinflationary spiral, and the absolute eroding of purchasing power for everybody. It was a disaster, at the end of which they finally issued a new currency that was tied to gold. And by having it tied to gold, it gave credibility to the currency. It caused, there were huge disruptions in the amount of, you know, what people owed. Your mortgages were just absolutely insane. I mean, how do you figure out what how do you deal with that? And when you owe somebody millions of dollars and suddenly it's not worth that anymore. You know, Russia went through this too, when they dumped the ruble and they brought in their new currency. Every time that you have to have this hit the reset button, it's legally and economically, it's just disastrous. It takes years to recover from it, and it did for Germany too. And this economic ruin left people with a bad taste in their mouth towards what we would term a liberal democracy, because it did not manage, it didn't keep the store for people. They lost their life savings, they lost their property, they were in complete shambles and ruins, they weren't able to get basic goods and services. And when somebody came along and said, you know, the way that they ran things is abhorrent. You should never have let them run things this way. If we had a strong central government, if we had, you know, national unity, if we had people who understood that this was brought on by foreign powers and evil in society, and we can push that out and we can focus on our nation and build it strong and take over, people went for that. And that was the rise of National Socialism in Germany. It came as, I believe, a direct result. And there are historians and scholars who disagree, who say that there were other factors that led to Hitler's rise, much more than the Weimar Republic's hyperinflation. But I see a direct correlation there. I see an eroding of national confidence and a loss of national identity, which led to someone with a strong voice saying, we are a great nation, and it wasn't our fault that all of this happened, and we can be great again, and people flocked to it. And it's a very dangerous time, especially when we look at the Fed's now ending policy of quantitative easing. Quantitative easing was the idea that if we have a recession coming in and people are going to be afraid that they're losing their jobs, and we were there. We had a huge problem in 2008, and people were very afraid of losing their jobs. Unemployment rates started going up drastically.
Oh yeah, it happened to us in our home. Yep.
So what do you do to keep people from hunkering down then? Well, you're going to have to put pressure on them to start spending. How do you get people to spend? Inflation. If you inflate the currency, people have to spend. Because all of a sudden, A, they have more money than they used to, which should help. People will feel more confident as they see wages rise. And then they'll start spending more because they have more money to spend. Even though they're not actually spending more, they're spending the same. They have the same buying power. It should cause people to increase velocity. When you increase the velocity, that should spur recovery. Okay?
Makes sense.
So it's really an illusion. You're not actually buying more. You're just spending more and getting the same amount. Mm-hmm. But it increases velocity, and that should create an upward pressure on the economy. So this is all a good idea. So what did they do? Well, the bond market was tanking. That was one of the biggest problems, is that our bonds were, the interest rate on our bonds was about to go up. And if the interest rates on bonds go up, which means that in order for us to get other people to buy our treasury bills, we have to offer them more money in return for the treasury bills, right?
Mm-hmm.
For example, let's say that you're looking for a good investment, okay? And there, you've got two cities that are issuing a municipal bond. One's going to be building a baseball stadium. One's going to be fixing some roads. They're both going to issue bonds. They both have the same rating. They both have the same, you know, credibility in the market for repaying their bonds. All things are equal. One's going to offer you 1% return. One's going to offer you a 2% return. Which one are you going to buy?
The higher return.
Absolutely. So let's say that all things are not equal. That the one who's trying to buy money for the stadium has had a history of not paying back their debt. And you go and you look at both, and the one that has a history of not paying back their debt, or the one that pays back their debt well, the one that has the AAA rating, says, we're offering 1%. And the one that has the bad history says, we're also offering 1%, because they are. Which one are you going to take?
Well, I'm going to look at their history, of course.
Mm-hmm. And you're going to take the one with the better credit history.
Of course.
So if you have a bad credit history, you have to offer more interest to get investors to be interested in you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we were. We were at a point where our financial institutions seemed to be in trouble. So in order for us to attract investment, we needed to offer higher interest rate to attract investment from, say, investing in England or France or anywhere else that you would invest this money in. Now, for the federal government, selling of treasury bills is a big deal. Now, I'm betting that neither you nor I, Amy, own any treasury bills.
That would be correct.
I bet you don't even own any savings bonds anymore, do you?
Correct.
Yeah. Who does? Who does this anymore?
Yep.
There was a point when I was in college, I was taking an economics class, and we were rapidly decreasing. We had a budget surplus, and the budget surplus in Washington was being paid towards the deficit. And there was a talk. This was a glorious time in American history, right at 2000, when there was talk of what do we do if we pay down the debt entirely? What happens if we don't have a national debt? Should we always have some debt? Should we just keep a little on the side so little old ladies can buy U.S. savings bonds? Is this something that's good for our economy overall? What do we do when we pay it all off? Of course, then we ended up in a bunch of foreign wars, and instead of choosing guns or butter, we chose both, and now we're pushing, what, $6 trillion in debt?
Oh, it's, gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a lot.
And we went from, in 15 years, we went from what happens if we actually pay off the entire debt to an insurmountable amount of money that can never be paid off.
No. It's not even possible anymore.
And doesn't that remind you of Germany?
Oh, yes.
Germany went from being an economic powerhouse and not having debt and doing fine to venturing into foreign wars, mm-hmm. creating huge amounts of internal and external debt, and the inability to pay it off. And their solution was, let's print money. So when we got to the financial crisis and we were running out of options because the T-bill interest rate was going to have to go higher. And if the T-bill's interest rate goes higher, then that means that at that time around $4 trillion in debt that we had, we would have to pay more and more towards interest. Mm-hmm. So it would be crushing. So the Federal Reserve turned around and said, okay, if the foreigners don't want to buy our bonds at 1%, we'll buy our own bonds at 1%. And that means that you don't have to offer a higher interest rate because you will get your money you need. You need, you know, $50 billion this month. We'll buy $50 billion worth of bonds and you'll have your $50 billion. Now, this is where the easing comes in. Where did they get the $50 billion? Did they sell gold to get $50 billion in dollars to be able to? Did they sell $50 billion worth of real estate to get it?
I don't think so.
No. They created the money. So our monetary supply went from X to Y. And every month it kept getting larger and larger and larger. Oh, from 2008 until now, every month the Federal Reserve has been printing money out of nothing to buy bonds to pay off the debt, which we're creating with no money. Mm. And as we spend money, as we make money to spend money, the price of goods that come in from foreign places goes up proportionally because the dollar is being devalued. Now, what's the best way to, and you should never look at any one good as an indicator of inflation because there are market pressures that can push any one good higher than others. But all things being equal, what is the best good out there to judge inflation by?
Gold. Ah, it would be gold.
Gold is always the best indicator of inflation. Gold has never been worth nothing. That's kind of an oxymoronic phrase, but mm-hmm. gold always has had value. Now, gold does not have any intrinsic value, which is very strange to me. There's a little bit in some of the higher electronic industries, you can get where gold has some properties that are useful. But for most people out there, you're not going to be able to do anything with gold. I mean, what do you do with gold? You make jewelry.
Right.
You know? What does that do mm-hmm. for you? Very, very little. It doesn't have, it's not like silver has antibiotic properties. Lead is extremely malleable, so it's easy to melt and form into things, although you don't really want to make drinking glasses out of it.
Not so much.
Or pewter. Yeah, they used to use pewter a lot for drinking goblets, and mm-hmm. people got sick from that. But that was in the 1700s. There are certain metals that do have intrinsic value, you know, that you can use them to do things. That gold isn't really like that. Gold doesn't really have anything. Palladium. Palladium is a precious metal that's used in catalytic converters, and it changes the amount of emissions that flows over it without being destroyed in the process. That's really cool. Mm-hmm. It can do something. Gold does squat. Right. All gold does is sit there. But gold has always been a medium exchange and has value. So let's look at the price of gold. In 1900, an ounce of gold cost $20, and you could take $20 and buy yourself a nice hand-tailored suit. In 1960s, gold was running around $100. Well, 1970s, gold was running around $100 an ounce. And you could take $100 and buy yourself a nicely tailored suit. In the 1980s and early 90s, gold was running around $300 an ounce. And you could take $300 and buy yourself a nicely tailored suit. Today, gold is running around $1,300 an ounce. And, you know, if you went and bought yourself a nicely tailored suit these days, you know how much it would cost? About $1,300. So, the good of the suit is a constant. The amount of gold it takes to procure that suit is a constant. And the price of the dollars in between is the variable. And we've watched the dollar erode over the last 8 years significantly. It's huge, the amount of money that we're not making. So this brings us to wages. Are wages keeping up with inflation? And we're going to get back to that in our last segment. Stick with us, folks. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
And now, back to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy.
Welcome back. Thanks for sticking with us. We left off this last segment talking about if wages are keeping up with inflation. That's kind of the big question.
And it is a huge question, because in some industries they are, in some industries they're not. But across the board, they are not. And the way that you can tell this instantly is, what is the talk about the minimum wage? Are people saying the minimum wage is appropriate? Are they asking for a slight increase in the minimum wage? Or are they asking for a huge increase
in the minimum? Yeah, it looks like a big one.
Yeah, and they are looking for a big increase. Well, the story out of McDonald's just recently is that McDonald's employees want to be paid how much an hour?
I believe it's 10, isn't it?
Or 14.
Oh, my. Now, where is that? What state is that in?
That was, I want to say Washington, but there was
I was going to say, if it's California, I understand.
And there was a protest at the McDonald's headquarters where they were demanding $14 an hour. Wages, and right. Everybody hit the roof. I mean, my goodness, who makes $14 an hour? You want $14 an hour for flipping burgers, man? We'll get an automated system and you'll be out of a job, and ha ha ha. Well, is $14 an hour really out of the question? Let's think back.
Well, I mean, I guess if you want to spend $10 for a hamburger, then no.
Well, yes and no. That's true. I mean, the cost of the employee salaries is going to be passed on to the end consumer. But aren't we already in the point where we're paying with inflated dollars? Let's look at what minimum wage was back in 2008. Okay? 2008 minimum wage was $6.75 an hour, and in 2009 it went to $7.25 an hour. So 2008 gold was $400 an ounce, give or take. That translated to minimum wage being just round up $7 an hour. Gold is now $1,300 an ounce. That's almost a fourfold increase. In order to have the same buying power. Now, gold is in a bit of a bubble, so it's not quite even. But if you look at price of meat, and you look at the price of gas, you're looking at about a 2.5 to 3 times increase. So if you were going to take that $7 an hour and translate it to being equal buying power today, you'd have to at least double it, at least, which would take you from 7 to 14, which makes sense.
Right.
So wages are not keeping up with inflation, not by a long shot. What happens if wages don't keep up with inflation?
You can't survive.
Yeah, that's exactly it. When you have inflation and the wages stay stagnant because market pressures are not going to increase wages, people's buying power decreases.
Right.
When your buying power decreases, you kill the velocity.
But there's also, you know, the argument that minimum wage wasn't necessarily meant for I don't want to say survive, but you know, to kind of pay.
Wage.
Yeah, living. Yeah, of course. Because I mean, this is meant for students who are getting themselves through college. This is not meant for you to live on long term.
Granted, and wages need to be higher than minimum wage in everything except for entry level positions. But when we replace all of our jobs that we're losing with entry level positions, something's got to give.
Mm-hmm.
Wages across the board must go up. And if all of our new jobs are in entry-level positions, they're going to have to be minimum wages that go up. Otherwise, you lose velocity. And with the loss of velocity and with the loss of spending, then you get a contraction, which is going to lead to people not spending money, which leads to layoffs, which leads to less goods, and less goods being chased by inflated dollars leads to hyperinflation. So, I mean, we are at a very critical juncture that people don't realize. If we do not get wages to start going higher to match up with inflation, we will hit a hyperinflationary spiral. And the Fed realizes that they have pushed this possibly past the breaking point, which is why they are ending their quantitative easing program. They're not going to be buying bonds anymore.
And so is this what's coming up in October? Tell us what's happening then in October.
They remember that the Fed has been printing money to buy bonds. This keeps the bond rate low. In October, they're going to, not all of a sudden, but over a period of time, start to cut off buying bonds. Their theory is that the economy is robust enough right now that investors will look at these 1% bonds that are now being on the market again. But up until now, you haven't been able to really buy many treasuries because the Fed buys them all. Mm-hmm. The Fed comes out and says, we're going to issue $1 billion in treasuries. We just bought $1 billion in treasuries. Thank you very much. And everyone is like, wait, I wanted to buy some. Well, they're all gone. Mm-hmm. Sorry. So if you wanted to buy treasuries, you've been out of luck. They're hoping that when they start to stop buying, people who have been waiting to buy, who have pent-up demand, will flood in and buy treasuries, which will keep the interest rate low. Mm-hmm. But if it doesn't work, interest rates will go higher because these bonds must be sold or we don't meet our debt obligations. So then you'll start to see interest rates go up. And all of your credit card interest rate, your student loan interest rates, everything except for home-backed securities are tied to the T-bill rate. So you're going to start to see your interest rates on everything go high. Right now, student loan interest rates are around 6%. They're tied to Treasury plus 2. Treasury right now is running at less than 0.5% interest. So if the Treasury rate goes up to 2% because they're no longer buying the T-bills, then your student loan rate is going to be over 8%. And you're going to see, and the difference between 8% and 6%, I watched when this happened. Mm-hmm. I had student loans when this happened. My interest rate dropped when they started doing this. It went from 8% to 6%. Mm-hmm. And I saved over $300 a month in student loan payments.
Wow, that's a big difference.
Yeah, watch it happen in reverse. Mm-hmm. Watch us hit this wall when that goes up. Credit card payments. All your credit cards are going to have, instead of having 18 to 21% interest, you're going to see 24 to 36% interest.
Can you imagine?
Yeah. Whew. Whoosh, there it goes. Mm-hmm. And who can make those minimum payments? Suddenly you're defaulting. And that's going to have a huge ripple effect. It could, it really could be the hitting of a brick wall for the economy if people are not buying those T-bills. Now, we would hope that the Fed would not allow that to happen. If they see the interest rates starting to go up, what are they going to do? Well, they're going to start buying them themselves again to push the interest rates back down, right?
I would imagine.
And then what happens to the buying power of your money? It's going to tank. Mm-hmm. And you're still making $9 an hour, and the value of your money takes a 50% drop. If you lost 50% of your buying power, could you make it? Of course not.
No. Mm-mm.
Then, again, depression. There's only one. You're looking at there's like 50 paths ahead of the U.S. There's only one where we come out without an economic collapse. And they're guiding us towards it, and they're crossing their fingers, and they're hoping the whole rest of the world plays ball. So let's look at what the rest of the world's doing. China and Russia are talking about creating a basket currency to get away from the dollar. The petrodollar is dead, it was a headline. In the Middle East, they're starting to look at selling oil and gas in local currencies. It used to be that 99% of all international transactions, the money that changed hands, were U.S. dollars. As of a couple of weeks ago, that number had dropped to 83%.
Wow.
17% are now done in local currencies. This is a huge loss in confidence in the dollar. And to think that they're going to start coming and buying up dollars like mad because they're on the open market again, I think it's ludicrous.
Now, does this have something to do with the United States losing some of their credit rating?
The credit rating is tied to us inflating our money. Mm-hmm. Because then when we lost some of our credit rating because we had so many dollars in circulation and nothing to back them up with. I mean, we back our money with the idea that the U.S. has a huge gross domestic product, and that works for a time until you hit a recession or a depression when our gross domestic product shrinks. The first quarter of this year was the first time in history that the U.S. economy shrank. That's huge. Guys, yeah. This is a big deal, and we are coming up on trouble. And the best thing that you can do is to start to prepare now, because the money is not going to be worth what it was. Having savings is not going to be much of anything if we hit a hyperinflationary period. Having durable goods, having canned goods, having real product that you can store up that keeps its value is a better idea. And that's where we get to Keystone Meats.
That's right. So the true prep, say that again. The true prep product of the week is Keystone Meat. And basically what Keystone Meat is basically meat in a can. There's chicken and
turkey,
pork and turkey, beef, you know, ground beef. And it's actually not bad. I mean, it's okay. It's pretty good, especially if you mix it in with a little bit of spaghetti sauce, put it on spaghetti. It's not bad at all.
It's kind of like hamburger that way. You don't just grill up hamburger, put nothing on it, and eat it as its own
right.
meal. And you wouldn't do that with this canned meat either. But it's very healthy because it's just meat and salt. Those
That's
are
right.
the only two ingredients. It runs around $9 a can. A can is about 2 pounds of meat. And go try to find meat now for, $4 a pound. You can't do it. Even
exactly.
hamburger.
And the nice thing is it does not have to be refrigerated. It's got a nice long shelf life, a minimum of 2 years, up to 10 is what I've heard.
Right. Yeah. And so this is a great product to be able to store up. Folks, you've been listening to Ready Radio this week. Tune in next week for another great discussion. This is News Talk 1160, the talk of the town.
You've been listening to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy. It's emergency preparedness for everyone. Brought to you by TruPrep. For all your prepping needs, visit TruPrep online at truprep.com or visit a TruPrep store in Roswell or Marietta. Tune in each week as Doug and Amy get you ready for anything that comes your way. Ready Radio, Saturday evenings at 5, only on News Talk 1160, the talk of the town.